Thank you for joining us today for our webcast and Hunton & Williams series, Hunton Global Privacy Update. I'm Bridget Tracy, a partner in the firm's London office, and I lead our privacy and cybersecurity practice in the UK. As a reminder, these webcasts are held every 2 months and are designed to provide informative updates on the latest issues in global privacy and data protection. We'll limit the webcast to 30 minutes in length, and after the program, we'll post an on-demand recording on our privacy blog at huntonprivacyblog.com. Today, to start off the new year, we'll provide a forecast of key privacy issues in 2014. Topics covered will include cybersecurity in the US, California's Do Not Track legislation, an update on Safe Harbor and the EU, including the current status of the regulation, and finally, the CNIL's new guidance on cookies. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce our global privacy and cybersecurity practice. We're located throughout the US, Europe, and Asia, and assist clients all over the world. We're recognized as privacy leaders globally. For more information, visit our blog mentioned earlier, huntonprivacyblog.com, and our EU data protection regulation tracker, huntonregulationtracker.com. And now I'm going to invite our practice chair, Lisa Soto, to provide us with an update on the latest cybersecurity developments in the United States and to provide an update on the policy environment in this area. Lisa.
Thank you, Bridget. I've been given 5 minutes to discuss U.S. cybersecurity issues, which, given the current environment, will just entice me to speak as quickly as humanly possible. So here we go. Beginning with the obvious, Target announced in mid-December that track data from about 40 million payment cards used at Target had been hacked. The relevant information later included encrypted PIN data and then names, email, and postal addresses and phone numbers for another 70 million customers. Then came Snapchat, followed by Neiman Marcus, and the list goes on. Meanwhile, Congress, which has been scrambling to craft the appropriate legislative response, did see some activity. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Leahy reintroduced the Personal Data Privacy and Security Act, which is a comprehensive information security package that Leahy had floated in each of the past four Congresses. It would replace the patchwork quilt of 46 state data breach notification laws with a uniform federal standard. And it would also impose new network security rules on businesses. Finally, it would beef up statutory penalties for computer hacking crimes under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Meanwhile, on the state front, the attorneys general from Connecticut and Illinois are leading a multi-state investigation into the Target breach. And we understand that attorneys general from about 30 states have joined the effort. Moving on to the President's Executive Order on Cybersecurity, NIST has been working assiduously to develop its framework of voluntary cybersecurity best practices for critical infrastructure. A draft framework was released for public comment in late October, and NIST plans to release the final version on February 13th. NIST received over 200 comments. These were publicly posted. And NIST has reviewed or is continuing to review the comments and revise the framework based on those comments. On the privacy front, the initial language in the framework was just abysmal. And this is being dropped as a result of an outcry over the draft language. The language that was contained in the October draft was in my opinion, not only extremely onerous, but in many cases irrelevant and occasionally nonsensical. So instead, the final version will incorporate high-level privacy language into a preamble section called How to Use the Framework. So the lofty goals on the privacy front have been traded clearly for embedding only general privacy principles. But NIST has also made it clear that it will continue to consider privacy standards and best practices as an area of focus. So there will be future work here, and I would venture to guess that we'll see changes in the next version of the framework, so stay tuned. NIST has said that they intend to continue as the convener for further discussion and refinement of the framework, and they're considering putting together a workshop in the next 4 to 6 months to review stakeholder experience with the first version of the framework. On the legislative front, I'll note that the House Cybersecurity Infrastructure Protection and Security Technologies Subcommittee marked up and reported out the National Cybersecurity and Critical Infrastructure Protection Act of 2013. The bill addresses the sharing of relevant threat information with owners and operators of critical infrastructure to prevent cyber incidents. So, to quickly sum it all up, there has been a great deal of activity on the cyber front, and we'll be paying close attention in 2014. Back to you, Bridget.
Thanks very much, Lisa. We're going to stay with the U.S. and move on to look at California's Do Not Track bill, which was passed in 2013 and became effective this year. Brittany Bacon from our New York office is going to provide this update. Brittany.
Thank you, Bridget. I will be speaking about California's new Do Not Track Transparency Bill, Assembly Bill number 370. This bill was passed in September of 2013 and became effective on January 1, 2014. AB 370 amends the California Online Privacy Protection Act to require two additional privacy policy disclosures for websites and online services regarding behavioral tracking. Given the scope of the California Online Privacy Protection Act, the new disclosure requirements apply broadly to cover any operator of a commercial website or online service that collects personally identifiable information through the Internet about individual consumers residing in California who use or visit its commercial website or online service. The application of AB 370 likely extends to mobile applications in light of public statements made by California Attorney General Harris interpreting the term online service. The amended law requires certain operators of commercial websites and other online services to disclose how they will respond to web browser do not track signals or other mechanisms that provide consumers the ability to exercise choice regarding the collection of PII about their online activities over time and across third-party websites or online services. Operators may comply with this requirement by providing a clear and conspicuous hyperlink in the operator's privacy policy to an online location containing a description, including the effects of any program or protocol the operator follows that offers the consumer that choice. This clause appears to permit businesses to satisfy the disclosure requirement by linking to a self-regulatory program in which they participate that offers consumer choice with respect to online behavior tracking. It is important to note that the scope of the consumer choice contemplated by AB 370 does not appear to be limited to tracking for purposes of interest-based advertising or online behavioral advertising. Rather, the provision applies more generally to any sort of tracking, even in cases where targeted ads are not being served. The bill's author has noted the distinction between opting out of receiving online behavioral advertising through, for example, the Digital Advertising Alliance, and allowing consumers to choose not to be tracked generally, which the DAA does not provide. The Assemblyman has said that this bill would require a website's existing privacy policy to disclose how it reacts to an individual's request to not be the subject of online tracking. In practice, a consumer wishing to communicate a do not track signal to websites would generally do so through their web browser controls. Although the major browser companies have offered do not track browser headers that signal to websites an individual's choice not to be tracked, there is no legal requirement for sites to actually honor the headers. The second disclosure requirement under AB 370 is to indicate whether other parties, third parties, may collect PII about an individual consumer's online activities over time and across different websites when a consumer uses the operator's website or service. In terms of enforcement, operators who fail to provide the requisite disclosures will be given a warning and then 30 days to comply before being deemed in violation of the law and subject to an enforcement action. Back to you, Bridget.
Thanks very much, Brittany. We're now going to turn to an issue that really spans the US and the EU and look at safe harbor. There have been a great deal of discussion and debate about this issue since last summer, and Monica Jedrzejowska, an associate in our New York office, is going to provide an update for us. Monica.
Thank you, Bridget. The Safe Harbor Framework is an important cross-border data transfer mechanism that enables certified organizations to move personal information from the European Union to the U.S. in compliance with European data protection laws. Since last summer, however, the Safe Harbor Framework has been under fire, which has intensified after the disclosure of the American government surveillance programs. More specifically, the Safe Harbor Framework has been the subject of criticism from the European Commission and some European data protection authorities. In July, the European Commission Vice President, Viviane Reding, openly criticized the Safe Harbor Framework by stating that the Safe Harbor Agreement may not be so safe after all. She then announced the Commission's plan to review the Safe Harbor Framework. And in November, the European Commission released the results of its review of the Safe Harbor Framework as well as other data transfer agreements. Among the documents published in November, the Commission released a set of frequently asked questions related to the issue of restoring the trust in the data flows between Europe and the U.S. In response to the question of what is the European Commission proposing today with regards to Safe Harbor, the Commission set out a list of 13 specific recommendations that relate to the Safe Harbor principles. The Commission called on the relevant U.S. authorities to identify remedies by summer of 2014. Some of the recommendations can be easily addressed by organizations and, in fact, already are met by a number of certified organizations. Certain of the recommendations, on the other hand, are more problematic and will be challenging to satisfy. For example, recommendation number 3 requires organizations certified to the Safe Harbor to publish the privacy provisions contained in any contracts with subcontractors. A number of the other recommendations relate to the enforcement of the Safe Harbor, including investigations of companies for which there has been a finding of noncompliance. There have been a few other publications that attack the Safe Harbor. For example, in the recently leaked Libby report, the Committee on Civil Liberties, Justice, and Home Affairs noted as one of its main findings that it takes the view that, as under the current circumstances, the Safe Harbor principles do not provide adequate protection for European citizens. These transfers should be carried out under other instruments. Despite the criticism, Safe Harbor remains a viable legal mechanism for transferring personal information from Europe to the U.S., and it seems unlikely that the Safe Harbor will be suspended in the near future. The U.S. Department of Commerce is actively engaged in the discussions around the Safe Harbor with U.S. stakeholders and European regulators. We will continue to closely monitor this issue. Back to you, Bridget.
Thanks very much, Monica. And as you said, this is something we'll continue to monitor. We're now going to turn to Europe specifically, where we have seen numerous developments in data protection over the last 12 months. Partner Wim Nauwelerts, who heads our Brussels privacy practice, will discuss the latest developments and in particular focusing on the proposed general data protection regulation, including the Commission's compromise text. Over to you, Wim.
Thank you, Bridget. Those who listened to our last update probably remember that in October of last year, the European Parliament's Libe Committee voted to back the European Commission's draft General Data Protection Regulation and gave a mandate to its rapporteurs to negotiate with the European Council with a view to reaching a consensus on a final text. With that, the ball was in the court of the Council, where in-depth discussions were held on the proposed regulation early December 2013. Now, the discussions focused mainly on the one-stop-shop mechanism and related questions on judicial review and redress. Although the Council supports the principle that in cross-border cases the regulation should establish a one-stop-shop mechanism in order to arrive at a single, consistent supervisory decision, the Lithuanian presidency could not reach a political compromise on the implementation of that principle. So the presidency concluded that there are different opinions as to whether the supervisory authority of the main establishment should be given limited exclusive powers to adopt corrective measures, and that more work was needed at the technical expert level. In particular, the council indicated that experts should explore methods for enhancing the proximity between individuals and the decision-making supervisory authority by involving the local supervisory authorities in the decision-making process. Now, according to the council, it should also be investigated whether in some cases the European Data Protection Board should have the power to adopt binding decisions regarding corrective measures. Now, since the beginning of January, Greece has taken over the presidency of the Council for a period of 6 months, and the Greek presidency has already indicated that it will treat the proposed regulation as one of its main priorities. In fact, it seems that the Greek government has ambitious objectives to reach an agreement by the summer. And for starters, at an informal meeting of the Justice and Home Affairs Council that will be held in Athens this week, the proposed data protection regulation will be on the agenda. It is interesting to note that at the end of last year, the Council prepared a revised version of the draft General Data Protection Regulation, which takes account of the discussions that took place in DAPIX, which is the Working Party on Information Exchange and Data Protection, under the Lithuanian presidency. And if you compare this version with the consolidated text that was adopted by the Parliament in October of last year, it becomes clear that the Council has different views on a number of important topics. Let me just give you a few examples. First of all, the Council takes the position that the right to the protection of personal data is not an absolute right. It must be considered in relation to its function in society and be balanced with all the fundamental rights in accordance with the principle of proportionality. And this is an important clarification that was not included in the proposal from the Commission or the compromise text of the Parliament. The DAPIX version also takes a different approach to the concept of main establishment, which, as you know, plays a key role in determining the competent supervisory authority. If processing is carried out by a group of undertakings, the main establishment of the controlling undertaking shall be considered as the main establishment of the group. However, it's not clear how this will work in practice if the controlling undertaking of the group is located outside the EEA. Also, in Article 7, that deals with conditions for consent, the DAPIX version requires unambiguous consent in normal cases, preserving explicit consent for processing of special categories of personal data, the so-called sensitive personal data. Now, the requirement added by the Libe Committee that consent should be purpose-limited and that it should lose its validity when the purpose ceases to exist was not retained by DAPIX. The DAPIX version adds that the prohibition on processing of sensitive personal data does not apply if processing is necessary for the purposes of social protection carried out in the public interest by public authorities or by bodies or associations, and subject to certain conditions and safeguards. Now, this additional legal basis for processing of sensitive data was not provided in the text from the Commission and the Parliament. To give another example, in principle, controllers should only choose processors that provide sufficient guarantees to implement appropriate technical and organizational measures to safeguard personal data. But according to the DAPIX text, the provision of sufficient guarantees may be demonstrated by means of adherence to codes of conduct or a certification mechanism. So this would create a strong incentive for processors to submit their processing to the certification mechanism described in Article 39 of the proposed regulation. And as far as documentation that controllers and processors should keep in order to demonstrate their compliance with the regulation is concerned, surprisingly, the DAPIX version includes more prescriptive requirements in comparison with the Parliament's compromise text. However, the requirements to cooperate with the supervisory authorities in Article 29 of the Commission and Parliament text have been deleted. And the DAPIX version is also less prescriptive in terms of data security requirements imposed on controllers and processors. An important distinction is also that only personal data breaches that are likely to severely affect the rights and freedom of data subjects will need to be notified to the supervisory authority within 72 hours. The DAPIX text also adds exemptions from notifying data breaches to data subjects. For instance, if such notification would involve disproportionate efforts, in which case there should be a public communication instead, or if the notification would adversely affect a substantial public interest. Now, in terms of data protection impact assessments, the DAPIC text introduces obligations for controllers only, so not for data processors. Furthermore, there would be less categories of specific risks that require a data protection impact assessment, but the supervisory authorities would be able to add additional categories. As opposed to the compromise text of the Parliament, supervisory authorities would only play an advisory role here, and there would be no mandatory compliance review of data protection impact assessment. The designation or appointment of a data protection officer is also fundamentally different in the text of DAPICS. A data protection officer would, or appointment of a data protection officer would basically become voluntary, and it would no longer be a statutory requirement to keep data protection officers for a period of 4 years in the case of employees or 2 years in the case of external service providers. However, the DAPICS text does specify that the data protection officer shall directly report to the highest management level of the controller or processor. And in terms of tasks of the data protection officer, again, the DAPICS version is considerably less prescriptive compared to the versions from the Commission and the Parliament. And with regard to data transfers outside of the EEA, the DAPICS text reintroduces the legitimate interest legal basis for data transfers that are not large-scale or frequent. The DAPICS text also proposes that international agreements involving the transfer of personal data to third countries, which were concluded prior to the entry into force of the regulation and which are in compliance with the Data Protection Directive, that those should remain in force until amended, replaced, or evoked. But the Commission has apparently already voiced strong doubts on the legality of that particular proposal. And last but not least, as far as administrative sanctions are concerned, the member states currently do not agree on a maximum fine in euros or in a percentage of an undertaking's annual turnover. So this will still require a lot of discussion at council level. I hope that this gives you a flavor of the differences between the DAPICS version that is currently discussed within the Council, the Parliament's compromise text, and the Commission's original proposal. And there is still a lot of alignment that needs to happen if the European institutions want to arrive at one single text under the Greek presidency before the summer. And on that bombshell, I turn it back to you, Bridget.
Thanks very much, Wim, and that certainly is a topic that we'll all continue to be very focused on. As our final slot today, I'd like to provide an update on some new guidance issued by the CNIL just prior to the holidays, focusing on cookies and cookie compliance. The report was prepared by our French qualified associate, Claire Francois. She's based in Brussels. And the report itself, the underlying report, can be found on the CNIL's website, although it's in French. So as Claire has explained to me, this guidance issued by the CNIL on the 16th of December focuses on cookie compliance and updates guidance that was issued originally in April 2012. The new guidance softens the CNIL's approach to the way in which users' consent can be obtained. And so this is important and a very practical piece of guidance for organizations. And you may remember that, as a general rule, users' prior consent needs to be obtained before placing or accessing cookies and similar technologies on users' devices. There are certain cookies that are exempt from the consent requirement under French data protection law. These are cookies whose sole purpose is to enable or facilitate electronic communications, or cookies that are strictly necessary for the provision of an online communication service that the user has expressly requested. It's also possible that some web analytics solutions might qualify for an exemption from consent, but to date, the CNIL has only recognized one such tool. In all other cases, web users' consent needs to be obtained before placing or reading cookies, and the consent needs to be obtained each time the technologies are used for a new purpose. The CNIL's new guidelines make it clear that all actors involved in the process of placing cookies
are jointly responsible for complying with the obligation. So the obligation for consent applies to website publishers, operating system and application publishers, advertising networks, social networks, and web analytics solution providers. The key point about the new guidelines, though, lies in the way in which users' consent can now be obtained. And in this respect, the guidelines recommend a much more pragmatic and flexible approach, which has two stages. The first stage is the use of a banner, so providing information to web users about cookies used on the site and their purposes. And the second stage is a recommendation that there's a link from the banner through to a further page containing more information about how to accept or refuse each type of cookie. Looking at each of these separately, the first step, the banner. The banner needs to appear on the home page or on a subpage of the website when a user visits it. And the banner needs to specify the exact purposes of the cookies and the fact that by continuing to use the website, the user accepts the use of the cookies. The banner also needs to contain a link through to a further informational page that explains how to change cookie settings to accept or refuse cookies. The new guidelines stress that the banner needs to remain until the user interacts with the website. If the user doesn't continue to use the website, the inaction can't be interpreted as the user's consent to the use of cookies. Moving through then to the second step, this is the more information page. The new guidelines provide that when a user clicks on the For More Information link provided in the banner, the user needs to be directed to information about how to accept or refuse each type of cookie placed on their device. And the information can either be presented as a cookie consent mechanism that's directly available on the website or application, or as a page containing a link to opt-out solutions offered by advertising networks, social networks, web analytics solutions providers, etc., assuming that those solutions are both user-friendly and actually work, or under some circumstances, provide details on how to modify browser settings to accept or refuse cookies. The two-stage approach, and in particular the first stage, are a clear departure from the CNIL's previous position. Previously, the CNIL required website operators to obtain users' explicit consent by ticking a box or clicking a button. Implied consent is now sufficient. If the user continues to navigate the site, that action is considered to be valid consent if the banner has been provided and the more information page is available. The CNIL's new guidelines also recommend that a user's cookie consent may be considered valid for up to 13 months. After that period, user's consent needs to be obtained again. And as a result, cookies should be programmed to expire 13 months after they're placed on a user's device. That's a brief overview of the CNIL's revised guidance on cookie compliance. And that brings us to the end of this webcast. The privacy world will continue to change, and we'll continue to monitor developments and report them on our blog. We'll also provide another privacy update. The next webcast is scheduled for Tuesday, the 18th of March. I hope that you can join us then. Thank you.